the CMU podcast in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Apple Music, The Slants and Morrissey. It's the CMU podcast, looking back at the last week in the music business. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook, who just accused me of being posh. Hello, Chris.
I said you sounded posh. I'm under no misconception that you are posh. It's just you've got one of those posh southern accents. So you said the Slants, but surely it's the Slants. Surely. Well, also, they're an American band. It's an American derogatory term that we probably shouldn't use too often. And in America, they speak like us northerners.
Not all of them.
And they would say slant. Well, they would say it in an American accent. But crucially, they would have the short vowel rather than the long vowel. Because that's one of the areas where America got the English language right.
Well, if you want me to hand over the use of all racist terms to you in this episode, that's fine.
Well, apparently I'm the only one who knows how to pronounce them on the team. That could be my job. My responsibility is knowing how to pronounce racist derogatory terms.
Which,
should
now,
we need to use them on the CMU podcast?
We were going to have to do this disclaimer later, and we probably will have to anyway. We should do it now. So there is a band that we're talking about called The
Slants.
And that's why we're using that term.
It's a derogatory term in America. Our British listeners probably have no idea what we're talking about, but it is a derogatory term in the US. They're an American band, and it is an act of reappropriation. Is that the word?
Yes.
So they're trying to reclaim what was an offensive term. Anyway, more of that later. I don't know why we're talking about that now.
Well, because you brought it up.
We've got a whole section, which now we'll have nothing to say about.
There's other stuff to say about.
It is quite an interesting story.
Yes.
If you're a fan of American trademark law like myself.
Yes.
So more of that later.
Yes. Before we get on to talking about what we're going to talk about this week, in addition to that, I should say it was CMU Daily's birthday this week.
It was. You know, on last week's podcast?
Yeah, when we said that was going to happen.
Oh, that was 2 weeks ago.
Was that 2 weeks ago?
Probably 3 weeks ago, because I think 2 weeks ago there wasn't a podcast.
That is true.
So I think 3 weeks ago we said that.
See, people would have forgotten by now.
On last week's podcast, I said in the introduction, after we had that incredibly long introduction, because it just turned out that we'd actually done something in the previous set, both of us had done something interesting. And so we went on at length about all the stuff we'd done. And then after that, I said, nothing is happening in the next week in the world of CMU.
Yeah,
so we'll have nothing to talk about. And what I forgot was, I was talking at the TuneCore Blueprint event in Nottingham on Saturday. We had the final CMU DIY Urban Development Red Bull Studios event of the season ahead of the summer break, which was particularly good. I think it's probably the best one we've had this year. That was because of our panellists. Not that our panellists previously. Our previous panellists were all good. In fact, they were really good. But this week's panellists were very good.
Right.
Pick your adjectives. So it was a particularly good session. So I should have plugged both of those events on last week's podcast, which I didn't.
Those happened.
And then we should also have acknowledged the fact that Wednesday just gone, as you're listening to this podcast, was the 15th anniversary of the CMU Daily launching. Because like the Queen, CMU has two birthdays.
Yeah.
So in May, we celebrate the anniversary of CMU at large. Although we didn't really do that this year because 19 years doesn't sound like it's worth celebrating, does it? Whereas next year, probably, isn't it? Do you celebrate 20 or 21? That's a bit weird. Society needs to sort that out. Why is it we're still celebrating that? And I'm going on a slight tangent here. The point is, our second birthday is the anniversary of when we launched the CMU Daily, which was on the 21st of June 2002. So that now means we have been publishing that bloody email every weekday. Obviously, we have a Christmas break, but pretty much every weekday, and we don't publish on bank holidays, but pretty much every weekday for the last 15 years.
It's too long, isn't it?
Too long.
It's too long.
Do you think we should give up
now? I think
we
should stop. It takes so long every day.
When do you think we peaked? What was the peak?
I mean, there was Michael Jackson.
We've said before that, not that we're suggesting the death of Michael Jackson was the glory moment in the history of CMU Daily. But that story, which obviously was a very sad story, but it was such a big story, both in terms of the music world and the music industry. And there were so many sort of legal ramifications and musical ramifications that we covered that in so much detail. And I suppose around about...
We're coming up to the anniversary of that as well.
We will be, yes. Yeah. But we're not quite. I mean, it was... Oh, I see. Yes,
25th of June.
Yes, it was during Glastonbury, wasn't it? But I thought you meant like a significant anniversary, and we're a couple of years away from the 10th anniversary, aren't we? And then, of course, there was the whole collapse of EMI. That was quite a big story that we covered. The collapse of HMV.
Yeah.
I think the problem is we haven't had a decent collapse in the recent years.
There Pandora.
That's
coming.
Pandora have just raised $680 million. I think they're fine.
That'll last them 2 months.
For the time being. So we need a spectacular collapse.
Spotify?
Because, that would be...
Spotify followed closely by the entire record industry.
That would be quite interesting to write about, but I actually hope that we don't end up writing about that. So, possible peaks there. There was that year, although I think this year was before you started writing for the CMU Daily, because you've not been writing for the full 15 years.
No.
You've been writing for how many?
Nine.
Nine of those 15 years. So clearly the peak was before that. There was the year where we mainly wrote about Pete Doherty.
Yes.
Which was drawing his sort of Kate Moss tabloid era.
Yes.
And at the end of that year, Caroline, so my business partner, who at the time also wrote the CMU Daily, she did that. It was one of those classic CMU incredibly weak gags. It was like Thrilled in 2015.
That was a good one.
That was a good one.
That took ages as
well. Well, exactly. It was another sort of quite weak gag. So you spent about a month putting together Thrilled in 2015.
I think it was 6 months on and off.
Well, yeah, but not solidly.
Pretty much.
And then there was that one year where at the end of the year, Caroline basically wrote out as one sentence every single thing that we'd reported on Pete Doherty doing that year. As one long sentence, and that was, as I say, it was sort of a mediocre gag that took Caroline a whole week. Because first of all, she had to go back through all the archive and work out what they all were, and then she had to write it up. So maybe these were the peaks. When I was looking back through the archives, as we were sort of putting together the little story we did around the 15th anniversary, one thing did occur to me, which is, did we ever find out what happened to Fiona Apple's dog? I don't think we ever followed up on that story.
Well, we'll have to research it later.
That was a few years ago now that she cancelled her touring activity because the poor dog wasn't well.
Yeah.
So I don't know whether the dog survived. So that was a failure. We're normally very good that once we latch onto a story at CMU, we pride ourselves in following every single step of that story. So once we've decided this is a story we're covering, we follow it every single step of the way. Hence our in-depth coverage of both Justin Bieber's haircuts and his tendency to walk into glass doors, both of which, they're not really in the news so much anymore.
No.
He's had pretty much the same haircut for a while, and he doesn't walk into walls anymore. But so once we've latched onto a story, we cover it in great detail. But we sort of failed in following up on the health of Fiona Apple's dog. So we better do some research on that.
Yeah.
And let our listeners
know. I'll look on Wikipedia.
Whether or not the dog's dead yet. So that's something to, to look into. So yeah, 15 years of the CMU Daily. So despite Andy Malt trying to talk us out of business, another 15 years to come, I'm sure. So if you're not a CMU Daily subscriber, but you're a CMU podcast subscriber, you should subscribe to the Daily too. Because if on the podcast we sort of fluff it all up and you don't really know what we're talking about, somewhere in that week's CMU Daily will be the stories that actually clarify everything. So we suggest that you also become a subscriber at completemusicupdate.com/signup. It's as simple as that.
Right. Good.
Well, it's also your birthday.
Today it is, yes.
Forget about the CMU Daily's birthday. It's your birthday today as we record. Yes. By the time this podcast goes out, it's long forgotten, and so there is no point trying to say to Andy Malt, happy birthday, because it will be embarrassingly late. Yeah. I did promise I was going to bring you, I have to say I forgot. The other day I bought, you know those little tubs of chocolate crispy thingies that you get at M&S? I bought one of them when I was going through Liverpool Street Station, and then I got home and it was like, actually it was so hot, you don't really want to eat chocolate when it's hot, do you? So I sort of left it out on the side, and then I realised that it was very hot in my house. So they all sort of joined up into a sort of one bucket-shaped chocolate crispy cake thing. And I was going to bring that in, put a candle on it and give it you, but I forgot. So I'm not sure I've got anything for you for your birthday.
It's the level of care and attention you get as an employee of CMU.
But I don't remember getting anything when it was my birthday a few weeks ago.
You don't celebrate your birthday.
I don't celebrate my birthday. But hey... yeah, I have nothing to give you. I can't think of anything to give you.
Fine, didn't want anything anyway.
I will get you a photograph of Fiona Apple's dog and get either the dog to sign it, or if it turns out the dog is dead, I'll get Fiona Apple to sign it. And then I'll send that to you. I'll get that sorted.
I look forward to that then. We should get on with this podcast.
If you want.
Well, coming up this week, as previously mentioned, the slant's getting trademark law rewritten in the US. We'll have Morrissey attempting to get HMV sales policy rewritten. But first, Apple Music is attempting to get agreements on how much money it gives labels rewritten. Just like Spotify.
Oh, I see. There was lots of
rewritten. That
there was
the,
a repeat.
Rule three.
Yeah. I think if you'd done better intonation, that would have stood out. But I can see it because I've got it written down in front of me. So it works for me because I can see it written down.
Well, everyone who's listening, I'll write it down and post it to them.
We'll email it to them.
I might rewrite it.
Well, there you go. So Apple Music is nearly 2 years old, talking of anniversaries. It feels like Apple Music has been around for a lot longer than 2 years. Because obviously it was big news when it came along. First of all, because it was Apple moving into streaming, having been the sort of the number one go-to download platform for all those years, the big move into streaming. And then, of course, the whole indie labels kicking up a fuss and then Taylor Swift swooping in and saving the day. So it was a big story when Apple Music went live, and it feels like it was about 24 years ago, not 2 years ago.
Well, slightly less than 2 years.
Slightly less than 2 years ago. But the point is, the two-year anniversary is coming up, and the deals that Apple did with the major record companies at that time and with the indie labels, Apple is interesting. I think we mentioned this on last week's podcast when we were talking about the latest Merlin stats. That with the indie labels, Apple deals direct rather than via Merlin, which negotiates the deals with all the other streaming services, because iTunes predates Merlin. And when Apple Music came along, they just added Apple Music onto the bottom of the iTunes deal. But those are 2 year deals. The 2 years are up. So just like Spotify, Apple Music are busy renegotiating their licensing deals with the majors and with the indies. And yes, from Bloomberg, we get the word, unsurprisingly, I guess, that just like Spotify, they're trying to get the rates they pay the record companies down.
Yes, and there are, I guess, several reasons for that. One is that publishers have been trying to get their level of royalties up. And if they get their levels of royalties up, then that has to come from somewhere.
Yes.
And the other thing is that obviously, while, you know, everyone always talks about how the split with streaming is that the rights holders get 70% and the streaming service gets 30%. But that's never really been the case, because actually there are minimum guarantees and advances. And as a result, the streaming services tend to hand over definitely more than 70% and probably quite a lot more, as much as 85% in some cases. And so the streaming services want to get that down, either by just renegotiating the royalty rate or getting down the minimum guarantees and squeezing it all so that, certainly in the case of Spotify, they can keep enough revenue that they might turn a profit one day.
You never know. A streaming service could become profitable.
Spotify financials just came out and showed that that is not happening by some margin at the moment.
So yes, as Apple and Spotify sit down with the record companies, and then subsequently they will be sitting down with the music publishers and the collecting societies. And I suppose, well, with the Spotify deals, which we've talked about before on the podcast, that felt like it was a real sort of game of bluff. Who will blink first? And they're still negotiating their new deals with Sony and Warner. They've done it with Universal and with the aforementioned Merlin. But we knew that Spotify were trying to get the revenue share splits down, because I suppose ultimately streaming deals, as you say, are revenue share arrangement. So the original deals that Spotify did, the record companies were getting somewhere between 55 to 60%. We know that Sony, that deal that leaked, their original American deal, they were on a 60% split. The publishers started off on about 10%, then went up to 12%. We hear on the grapevine, obviously all these deals are secret, but that the big publishers are getting closer to 15%. And as you say, that means that, well, if the publishers are getting more of the rev share, does that come out of the streaming services cut, or do they negotiate the record companies down? And the streaming companies have been quite adamant throughout, and indeed through the Entertainment Retailers Association here in the UK, which represents most of the streaming services, not Apple Music as it happens, but represents Spotify, Deezer, etc. They put out a report, didn't they, a couple of years ago, where they explicitly said 30% is as low as we can go. And any lower than 30%, we're going to go out of business, and nobody wants that. And so, yes, what we've seen in the latest round of licensing negotiations is an attempt to get it down below the 55% in many cases, partly to compensate for the fact that they're paying the publishers more, and partly because, yeah, they need to turn these businesses profitable. And the reason why it's a game of bluff, I mean, obviously, the record companies would like as big a slice of the digital pie, as we call it, as they can get. Having said that, if the publishers are getting more, they're also all although they do the deals separately, the biggest publishers in the world are Sony, Universal and Warner, and the biggest record companies in the world are Sony, Universal and Warner. But actually, if you're a music rights owner, if you are Universal Music, and you have a record company over here, and you've got a publisher over here, you would prefer more money to come through your record company than your publisher. Obviously, your songwriters would like more to come through the publisher. But because of the way record deals and publishing deals work, a classic major record company deal, the label keeps most of the money and the artist gets a small portion of the money. Whereas with a publishing deal, The songwriter gets most of the money and the publisher keeps a minority. And that's the way the music industry has generally worked. So the big music rights owners, even though you could say, well, what difference does it make? Ultimately, they're getting 70% across their two businesses. They would prefer more to go through their record companies. Having said that, you know, if you are a Spotify and you can say, well, hey, Universal Music, we are paying more to Universal Music Publishing. Hey, Sony Music, we're paying more to Sony ATV Publishing. So you need to come down accordingly. But also, we talked last week, didn't we, of the Merlin figures and a few weeks ago of the IFPI figures. Streaming now is such a big portion of the record company's income. And certainly in Europe, the vast majority of that money is coming from these two services, Spotify and Apple,
yeah,
with a bit of Deezer in France. And then in North America, I suppose there's Pandora and iHeart. But it's a really small number of services that are bringing in all this streaming income, which is increasingly by far the biggest revenue stream for many labels. So that's where the game of bluff comes from, that a Spotify and even an Apple Music will say, it's in your interest for us to go into profit. Because if Spotify does collapse, as you alluded to earlier, everyone's screwed.
Yeah.
And so hence the game of bluff. Okay, yes, you want more money, but you've got to help us make this work. Otherwise, we're all going to go out of business. So hence the sort of negotiations. But the Apple talks are ongoing. It seems unlikely they're going to get these new deals done by the end of the month when the initial two-year deals expire. So what happens then is that the old deal just rolls on month to month until they can agree that new deal.
Yes, I suppose the difference between Spotify and an Apple Music is that Spotify's business is entirely predicated on streaming being a profitable business, whereas Apple Music exists to be a feature on some phones that makes people like the phones. So ultimately, it matters less for Apple Music if it exists or not.
Yeah, I suppose that's the interesting thing, isn't it? That you could say, well, Apple Music on one level only needs to break even. It doesn't need to be profitable because it's helping selling phones. Although you could flip that over and say, that was certainly true of iTunes. When Apple set up the iTunes store, it wasn't about making money. It was about providing content so their iPods were worth having. So actually, originally, iTunes was, if we break even, then that's brilliant. And in the end, as it turned out, they made a load of money from iTunes. I think with Apple Music, on one level, perhaps they just need to break even. On another level, if you look at Apple's business model, whereas it used to be they sold devices and the services were just about making the devices more attractive, the services part of Apple's business, of which Apple Music is part, is becoming a bigger part of the business. So there may be an element of saying, actually, probably break even wouldn't be enough for Apple. They don't necessarily need to make as much profit as Spotify because they have other revenue streams, lots of other revenue streams, but probably they do want to make a profit out of Apple Music. And certainly, they don't want to make a loss out of Apple Music. And although I think it would be, I don't think Apple would shut down Apple Music overnight because they like being big in music. And I don't know, actually. I mean, no one's buying an iPhone because of Apple Music, are they? So
no, but it's more, I think, that once you've started paying for Apple services, like, I don't pay for Apple Music, but I do pay for extra online storage, and that locks me into the Apple ecosystem. And it would be a pain to move somewhere else now and have to find a new service, go back to Dropbox and have that not work. You know, so once you're locked in with things like that, it does keep you buying new devices. And I have Apple TV as well. I'm totally locked in to the Apple universe.
Except you're a Spotify subscriber.
Yes.
So that's the interesting thing, isn't it? Yes, they couldn't shut down all the other elements of the old iTunes.
That's why they have multiple services. They get you somewhere along the line.
But perhaps they could shut down the streaming bit. I mean, they're not going to anytime soon. But I suppose the point is, yes, Apple probably don't need Apple Music to be profitable at all, or at least so profitable, whereas Spotify desperately need it to be profitable. But then the flip side is Spotify can't shut down Spotify, because if Spotify shuts down Spotify, it's out of business and everyone loses their money. Whereas actually, although it would be a climb down for Apple and it would be a PR challenge, if they shut down their streaming music service, it ain't going to affect Apple. They're still going to be a really successful company. So both Spotify and Apple have some strength to their negotiating position. Hence why, in the main, the record companies are open to this conversation. Okay, our publishing divisions are earning slightly more. You need to turn your business model to make it work. I mean, as you mentioned, as far as I can see, actually, the problem at the moment isn't so much the revenue share, it's the minimum guarantees. The
yes.
fact that in theory, all these services should be keeping 30% of their income. As you say, the latest figures suggest that Spotify kept 15% last
yeah.
year, which is 2% more than the previous year, so it's improving.
But it's considerably less than 30%.
Exactly. And so they need to find a way to get to keeping at least the 30% and maybe slightly more. But the labels are open to sort of being flexible on these deals, although obviously they want something in return. And so what we believe Spotify gave Universal in return was, well, first of all, commitments on growth. So the better rates are reliant on Spotify growing their subscriber base. And I imagine that will be their premium subscriber base because that's where the real money is to a certain extent. Also, you have the whole windowing thing. That's not an issue on Apple Music, of course, because they don't have the free level. They only have the free trials and Beats 1. And also, we know that Spotify are offering better data. And that might be something that Apple start offering as part of their deal. Spotify generally being ahead on stuff like that because they've just been going a lot longer. So there probably will be some extra kickbacks in the deal for the record companies. But the rumours are that the majors and the indies are up for offering Apple Music pretty much the same as what they've offered Spotify, but they'll want some kickbacks in return. So we're still waiting for some of those Spotify deals to be done, and then there are all the Apple Music deals to be done. But the whole streaming business continues to fluctuate, but let's just hope for everybody that at least some of these services can make themselves viable long term.
Still to come, we've got some news in brief, plus Morrissey's attempt to boost eBay prices for his records. But now back to American band
The Slants,
who have,
or The Slants if you prefer,
either or, I don't mind. They've set a significant precedent in American trademark law after the US Supreme Court upheld a lower court ruling to the effect that the country's First Amendment free speech rights mean trademark applications can't be rejected on the basis that they are offensive.
So I find this a fascinating case. And hey, it's got a music angle, which is how I'm justified talking about it on the CMU podcast, even though it's American law and it's an American band that probably most of our British listeners have never heard of, who have used a derogatory term in their band title, which most of our British listeners won't be aware is a derogatory term. It's quite an American story. But it is a big story in the context of US trademark law and free speech rights. So yes, trademarks are interesting, aren't they? So you trademark names, you trademark logos, you generally trademark things that aren't protected by copyright. And in most countries, actually, I mean, the US is an exception here. In most countries, copyright isn't a registered right. The copyright exists the minute you create and publish the work. Actually, there is some copyright registration in the US. But trademark is different. You have to register to get trademark protection. And that's true in every country. So here in the UK, you have to register. You can get one registration for the entirety of the European Union at the moment. That's another question to come. But you have to register with a trademark registry in order to get trademark protection in every country where you want protection. So if you are a band or an artist and you want trademark protection for your name and or your logo, you have to go to all the trademark registries, and they all have their own rules about how you register, what form you have to fill out, how long it takes, and what you can and can't trademark. So some common rules in a lot of trademark registries are things like you can't trademark swear words quite often. You can't trademark city names. You can't trademark God or Jesus or things like that. So most trademark registries will have a set of rules about what you can and can't trademark. Yeah. Obviously, you can't trademark anything that has already been trademarked within your sector, within
that's
your
sort
industry.
Of the point.
That's sort of the point. So that's the biggest limitation. You can only get trademark protection within the sectors in which you operate. So you can have people using the same trademark.
And you have to then use that in a significant commercial way.
You do.
I learnt listening to another podcast.
Yes. Otherwise, yes, ultimately you will lose a trademark. And I suppose that's another interesting thing about trademarks, where trademarks are different to copyright and the other sorts of intellectual property, so designs and patents, in that trademarks last forever, providing you continue to use them. So I think in the UK, the oldest trademark, look at me with my trademark law. I don't normally talk about trademark law, do I? I'm normally about copyright law. I only know about six things about trademark law, of which I'm going to give you all six now, because it's not, well, I say it's not so relevant to the music industry. Actually, if you're a superstar artist, if you are a Beyonce or a Taylor Swift, you actually probably make more money exploiting your trademarks for your perfume deal and your mobile deal and your fashion deal than you do out of your music. So the music industry is in the trademark business at the upper end. The oldest trademark in the UK, and possibly the oldest trademark in the world, is the Bass Brewers trademark.
Really?
And when they got the exclusive rights to that name, it wasn't even called trademark in those days. And they've had that for a long time, and they will have it forever, providing they continue to use it. But yes, if you stop using it, you lose it. So every country has its own rules on what you can and can't trademark. And in America, trademark law there, which the Trademark Act has a weird name because it's named after the senator that proposed it or something.
The Lanham Act?
Yes, because Mr. Lanham... He didn't look at your notes at all. Mr. Lanham sort of led on this. So the American Trademark Act, like most other trademark systems, it says you can trademark names that haven't been previously trademarked, but then it has a list of things that you can't trademark. And so it says a trademark application can be rejected by the US Patents and Trademark Office, so the registry in America. They can reject trademark applications based on a list of criteria.
One of which is disparaging persons, institutions, beliefs, or national symbols, which is the one relevant to this story.
Yes. So
that's why I said that.
One of the bullet points in the Trademark Act says that a registry is able to reject trademark applications that, so it's disparaging, what did you say, persons, institutions, beliefs, or national symbols. And so under that, you have had various applications over the years using derogatory terms, which are derogatory about a group of people. So basically sort of racist or xenophobic language. And I was reading around this when this story sort of popped up in the Newswire. So I think I may have got this wrong, but I think I'm right in saying basically the trademark registry has always been a little bit inconsistent on this as to what they decide. And one day they'll say, oh, that's an offensive term, you can't trademark that. And then the next day they'll say, oh, you can trademark that. And so, for example, I think NWA were able to trademark, even though the N in essence stands for the N word. Mm-hmm. And then another artist who wanted to register their name, which also contained the N word, albeit written out, N word obviously being a very offensive word, hence why I'm saying the N word, they weren't allowed. So it was sort of inconsistent. But crucially, the Trademark Act, in theory, empowered the trademark registry to make those judgments and to say, nope, that's an offensive word, so you can't trademark it. Then you have this band called The Slants, who are an American Asian band. So most of the members are of, they're American, but they're, I suppose their families are of Asian descent.
Yeah.
They decided to call their band The Slants. Slant being a derogatory term for people of Asian descent, particularly so Southeast Asian descent in the US. And as I say, they were very adamant that they were picking this as reappropriation. So this was a derogatory term that they lived with when they were growing up. And they wanted, to, in essence, to respond to that and own this word by calling their band that name.
Yeah, so Simon Tam, who is the front man of the band, and like, there have been various members of the band over the last decade or so, and he's the kind of, he's always been there at the front, it's his band, and he said in an interview with CBS News earlier this year, I was ridiculed as a kid for having slanted eyes, now I'm saying it's something that I can be proud of, not something to be ashamed of. So there, actually reappropriation is turning it around, saying it's not a bad thing. Ah, stupid people using it as a derogatory term.
And I suppose you've had the same thing with things like Queer Eye for the Straight Guy and Queer as Folk. So that was a term that was originally derogatory, and then the gay community sort of embraced that. And indeed, those are both examples of things that were successfully trademarked in the US with the trademark registry, when some people might have said it's a similar thing. You know,
yeah.
Well, ultimately, that the history of that term is it's a derogatory term, yet you're allowing people to trademark it, probably on the basis that they have reappropriated the term. So yes, when Simon Tam tried to register this trademark, this is quite a few years ago now, it was rejected and he decided to fight the trademark office on this, and he did so on First Amendment grounds, because of course the First Amendment of the American Constitution, amongst a whole load of other stuff, contains the free speech elements that says the government will not interfere in the free speech rights of American citizens. And so his argument was, it may well say in trademark law that the trademark office has the power to reject trademarks on these grounds, but he believes that contravenes the First Amendment. And of course, the Constitution always supersedes anything that is passed in Congress. And so he took the matter to court. It's been working its way through the system for quite some time. But the news this week is it had reached Supreme Court, right at the top, and the Supreme Court ruled on the matter.
Yeah, so one of the judges who was involved in that ruling, Samuel Alito, said that the element of US trademark law that said that you could reject on grounds of offence offends the bedrock First Amendment principle. Speech may not be banned on the grounds that it expresses ideas that offend. Therefore, the band may have their trademark.
Yes. So two things here. The band get their trademark. But more importantly, that does rewrite trademark law, because it's basically saying, OK, that bit of Trademark Act can't stand, or it certainly can't be interpreted in that way. And from this point onwards, the trademark registry in the US, only the US, of course, is an American case, cannot reject trademark applications on the grounds of offence. And that may well now result in a number of applications being put forward. And I suppose that'll be an interesting thing, that obviously this band were trying to trademark this word as an act of reappropriation, whereas you might now have people who are genuinely trademarking offensive words because they're offensive people being offensive. And I suppose that's always the challenge with free speech rights, that when you enforce free speech rights, you enforce the free speech rights of idiots who don't want to offend for sort of creative, contentious reasons. They just want to be nasty.
Yeah, well, and then you've got things like the Washington Redskins, the American football team, whose name has always been contentious.
And they've had trademark issues in recent years because of that.
And so that could help them get a trademark, but then that, you know, that's only going to open up more criticism from all the people who just don't understand why they don't just change their name and stop using a derogatory term for Native Americans.
So, as is often the way with landmark free speech cases, on one level, good free speech rights were enforced. On another level, what precedent have we set here? Have we opened some floodgates? So it will be interesting to see. But in the time being, this particular band were very pleased with the result and felt that they had been vindicated, and they can now trademark their band name. I don't know if that means we're going to get a LaSlants perfume by the end of the year. That's generally how you make money out of your trademarks in the music industry. I imagine they'll probably be putting on T-shirts and things like that.
Just quickly, time for some news in brief. Now, police have raided the headquarters of Spanish collecting society SGAE, and not for the first time.
Yeah, again. We've often talked about having a panel at The Great Escape where we get songwriters from four different countries, and the panel would be, my collecting society is worse than your collecting society. And they would all have to present an argument as to why their country's collecting society is rubbish. I think Spanish songwriters would do quite well in that panel. So yes, the Spanish equivalent of PRS, so it's the Songwriters Collecting Society in Spain, has been accused of corruption and fraud at various times in recent years. So the fraud squad raided there a few years ago. It only actually led to one guy being jailed for fraud. And I think a lot of people expected there to be more fallout from that particular raid. But they've raided again. This time it's to do with a scam whereby writers who are members of the society sort of team up with TV executives, and they basically log some works, which are basically public domain works that they've changed a few notes. And then the TV executives sync all of that into overnight telly. So if you watch overnight telly in Spain, it's all really rubbish, reworked public domain compositions. And then the system's seemingly weirdly set up that there's good royalties to be made from overnight TV sync. And so it's seen as a scam, and so an investigation has begun. And 18 people, I believe, were detained, was the word that the local press were using, to try and put an end to that scam. So yeah, another controversy for the Spanish Collecting Society, which has been trying to overcome all of these corruption allegations since the last raid. But that's not going to do anything for their reputation.
No. Jay-Z has announced that he's going to release a new album on the 30th of June, exclusively on Tidal.
Yeah, he's the one person still hanging on to exclusives.
That's not the big news.
No, that's not the big news.
The big news is that he's found his hyphen. He dropped the hyphen from his name with his last album, and now it's back.
Yeah, so obviously originally Jay-Z was J-A-Y hyphen Z.
Yeah.
Let's use the British pronunciation. That's something where the Americans have got it wrong. So that was how we spelt Jay-Z. And then a few years ago, it was like, nope, no dash, no dash, which really played the metadata systems on streaming services have to sort of be able to cope with the fact that some Jay-Z tracks are written one way and some Jay-Z tracks are written another way.
Also, I mean, most media seem to have fallen in line with that and gone, oh, right, well, we won't write it with a hyphen anymore, even though it does not matter. So we carried on writing with a hyphen.
We carried on writing with a hyphen. I was really... Although we allowed Kesha to lose her dollar sign, so we're inconsistent.
We did, but I never liked the dollar sign, I wasn't bothered about that. But I was reading an article a few weeks ago that was about Jay-Z, and at the bottom it had a correction. It said updated whatever date to reflect that Jay-Z no longer has a hyphen in his name. So it doesn't matter. Leave it.
But he does now have a hyphen in his name.
So you're going to have to put it back.
The hyphen is back. And not only is the hyphen is back, but seemingly from the press announcements that went out around this new album, not only is there a hyphen, he's now doing it all caps, uppercase. Am I right in saying that?
We do not allow anyone to have all caps names. That is bullshit, mate.
FYI, for any artists listening, or labels who represent artists, if you want your artist name to be written in capital letters in the CMU Daily, which obviously is the most important place yep. your artist covered. So the rule we have, Andy's in charge of our style guard.
If it actually stands, if it's an abbreviation that stands for something, then so, all right.
So you allow MIA
yeah.
to have
or
MIA.
NWA.
Or NWA to be NWA. But you will not allow JAY-Z in capital letters until he tells us what it stands for.
Yeah, and if it turns out it does stand for something, then all right, maybe we'll reconsider.
Yes.
But I don't think that it does.
Well, we'll see.
Lastly, in our news in brief, the really big news of the week was that Napalm Death frontman Barney Greenway was interviewed by Ed Miliband on Radio 2.
Yes.
That's really all you need to know about that story.
You were sort of saying in your write-up of this, don't know why this has happened now. It's clearly happened now. Well, A, because Ed Miliband was the guest host this week
on Radio
2. I
know why it's happened now.
But it's also happened now because of the whole Glastonbury thing and the fact that we've got the metal stage at Glastonbury and that's a new thing.
Yeah.
And it's Glastonbury week. That's why it's newsworthy.
I don't entirely know why it was on Radio 2.
Well,
other than it was a Jeremy Vine show, and that's the show where people phone in and say, I don't think that's a good thing, what people did. Actually, it was balanced. Some people phoned up and said, I like Napalm Death, and some people phoned up and said, I don't know what this is, but I don't like it, which is how all of those shows work.
It is true. Although the Jeremy Vine show is a particularly fine radio show, because one of my friends works on the production team there, so... My sister likes it. My sister's an avid listener. That one time...
I used to listen to it when I used to listen to radio.
That one time I went on the Jeremy Vine show to talk about happy birthday copyrights, I think. It would have been copyright, wouldn't it, if I was going on. And my sister was very excited about that because it was the Jeremy Vine show and she listens to the Jeremy Vine show.
It is a good show.
But it was the Jeremy Vine show with Ed Miliband because Jeremy Vine's on holiday. And so, yes, getting a little bit of very noisy metal onto daytime Radio 2...
Broken by Shalimar, that was the best bit.
In the middle.
We'll be talking to Barney from Napalm Death a bit more in a few minutes after Shalimar. That was my favourite bit.
That was your favourite bit.
Anyway, you can read all of those stories in full on our website. If you go to completemusicupdate.com/podcast, you'll find the show notes for this show and links to all of them. Finally... on this week's CMU podcast, it's Morrissey and the shooting fish in a barrel of And Finally stories that is anything that Morrissey says.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it, how going back to CMU editorial policy that seems to have been a feature of this week's podcast, you sort of ruled, didn't you, that Gallagher spats were no longer worth writing about because they became so passé because there were so many Gallagher spats. Yet you're still... fully on it whenever Morrissey says something nonsense, even though as everything that Morrissey ever says.
I try not to put Morrissey in the beef of the week column because it's too easy. And I do miss, there are some, and like he issues a statement about the Queen probably once every 2 weeks. And I generally ignore those now, unless we're really desperate for stories. But sometimes he says something that's so just brilliant, it's worth writing about. And this week it was his attack on HMV.
Yeah, relevant to the Queen, because this is all about the limited edition vinyl reissue of The Queen Is Dead that you are able to buy on both 7-inch and 12-inch, I believe.
Yeah.
But only in record shops, people.
Yes.
These are not officially available online. You have to go to a record shop, and HMV had an allocation of these, which was good timing, because it was vinyl week in HMV.
Yeah.
And they were filling their shelves with limited edition vinyl reissues.
Yes, so Morrissey popped into HMV to buy his own records. Seemingly a thing he does. And he noticed that both of these records had a sticker on them saying, limited to one copy per customer. And he saw that and didn't think, oh, they're limiting that so that people don't buy up 10 and put 9 of them on eBay, or even all 10 of them. He saw it and thought, why are they trying to suppress the Smiths' record sales and stop us getting in the charts, which you would think a limited edition vinyl release is never going to do anyway.
No, and also that's him assuming that all of his fans or maybe his former fans, fans of his former band, would always want to buy multiple copies of the same record.
Yeah, I'm not sure why he was so convinced that every Smiths fan wants multiple copies
of
every record.
I know one person who's a real vinyl junkie who does often buy two copies, one to play and one to keep pristine.
Well, that person is a bad person.
But that's one person in the whole world. Who else is it who wants to buy it more than one copy.
If you buy vinyl and don't play it, you shouldn't be allowed to listen to music.
Well, that's
things
a lot.
Are made to be used.
That's a lot of vinyl users. So yeah, so Morrissey went into HMV, saw that they put these stickers on the limited edition vinyl releases. He took a photo of them, and then he got his laptop out and he typed in an angry blog post, which was posted
on Facebook.
On Facebook. On so the limited edition vinyl release of The Queen Is Dead came out on New Music Friday. Vinyl Week at HMV didn't actually start till the Saturday.
Yes.
Which I think is behind this story, because it meant that the Smiths vinyl was in HMV on the Friday, which was sort of part of Vinyl Week, but Vinyl Week hadn't started, and then all of the other limited edition was then added on the Saturday morning. And I suppose that was behind... Well, his allegation was it was the only record in the entirety of HMV that had the limited to one purchase per customer sticker. And that's hence his conspiracy theory, that there was a conspiracy against his release.
Yes, because actually, if he'd been in on the Saturday, he would have seen there'd be a whole rack of Vinyl Week exclusive releases, all of which had this sticker on. But we're assuming that he went on the Friday and it was only his record. Still, it's not... You know, that's not an uncommon sticker to see on very limited releases that a lot of people are going to want.
Well, I suppose still, that also, it's kind of come out of Record Store Day, hasn't it? Because every year, I mean, Record Store Day is not quite what it used to be, but when Record Store Day was like a really big thing, there was every year, there was the whole, oh my God, they only released 100 copies of these records, and look, 99 of them are for sale on eBay immediately. And so it has sort of become a thing with limited edition. We want to stop the eBay resellers from buying them all up and then trying to make a markup. So actually, HMV were doing a good thing.
Yes, they were, you could say. But Morrissey said it was an attempt to freeze sales, and it was an overwhelming insult to the Smiths and their artistic freedom. And it was supporting a culture of banality, because he felt that by suppressing their sales, they were just trying to make sure that kind of more vacuous pop music got into the charts. And then he started claiming that the song was in the top 10, even though it hadn't been supported by radio, even though it's not in the top 10. And it hasn't been supported by radio because it's not a new single and it's only being released on vinyl. So why would it be on Radio 1 anyway? So it's...
Wasn't it entirely clear which top 10 he was talking about? Because obviously this was the day after it had been released. So he wasn't talking about the top 10, because it couldn't have been in
the
top 10.
He did say the UK top 10.
So it may well be that he was seeing, you know, some of the sort of the early data that comes out of the chart company. As you say, because it was a limited edition release, you would think it... I mean, who knows? We're recording this podcast before the actual chart has been published.
Yeah, I mean, it could be number one.
But there is a vinyl chart, isn't there? So
yes,
it might be that it does quite well in the vinyl chart, because as we've talked about a lot on the podcast, despite all of the excitement around the vinyl revival, actually unit sales of vinyl are quite low. So it could conceivably do well in the vinyl chart, although it was up against all of the other limited edition vinyl that was going on in HMV this week.
Yeah, I think Ed Sheeran might do all right.
He probably will.
Anyway, yeah, so Morrissey suggested that if you are in possession of 7 variable wigs, a box containing false noses, multiple-sized plastic clip-on ears, a nurse outfit, a set of stilts, a Superman cape, and a variety of oddly shaped spectacles, then we urge you to use them now and buy as many copies of The Queen Is Dead at HMV as you desire.
Yeah, that was his solution to this draconian conspiracy at HMV to stop you from buying the 87 copies of his single you would clearly want.
There was an issue with that, which HMV eventually pointed out when HMV eventually issued a statement on this. They said, our stores are encouraged to use these stickers where a release is known to be extremely limited in order to prevent bulk buying and online resales at inflated prices, which it did not stop, because you can buy a lot of these on eBay. This approach gives genuine fans as much chance as possible to find and buy a copy. Over 90% of the allocation we were given across both formats was sold out before Morrissey posted his comments on Saturday evening. So I don't think you would have needed that many costumes in order to buy up the remaining stock.
Yeah, even if you wanted 87, the chances were your local HMV would only have 2 copies left.
But as I said, if you go on eBay, you will have no trouble buying them at more than you would have paid in HMV.
You see, you're saying that that is proof that the sticker system doesn't work, that HMV aren't enforcing that strongly enough.
Well, not necessarily. But it
may well be that on the back of Morrissey's blog, there was a whole load of eBay resellers who were dressing up on Saturday to buy it. Well, it had to be Sunday, wouldn't it, after Morrissey's blog was posted.
And anyway, I wasn't saying that HMV weren't enforcing the rules. I just think it's quite likely that someone might have gone into HMV and bought one copy of each record and then just put it on eBay.
Yeah, with
maybe
intent
they went, maybe they went to different shops.
I have to think that if you went into HMV and bought a copy and then went to have a coffee and then went back to HMV, you wouldn't have to put on a wig. I don't think they're going to remember you to stop you buying. You can't run two through the same transaction on the till, I think is the point. You could keep going back in during the day and get the all 87 copies that you want, either for yourself or to resell on eBay.
Which is more likely.
Which is more likely. Anyway, another fun Morrissey rant for you there. I don't think he's responded to HMV's response.
No, that's a shame, isn't it?
So perhaps that's still to come.
Maybe. Well, that's all we've got time for this week anyway. We'll go and check now if Morrissey has actually issued a response. But in the meantime, why don't you like, rate, share and subscribe to this podcast if, you know, you haven't done those things anyway. You can like, rate and share as many times as you like, but subscription, that's really only something you can do once.
You could
unsubscribe and resubscribe.
You know, I said CMU has two birthdays like the Queen.
Yeah.
The CMU podcast birthday must be coming up because we launched it in June, July. It was sort of early summer.
Well, it depends which version of the podcast.
It's true.
We celebrate both birthdays of the podcast.
Yeah, so that's four birthdays. So we'll check that out because it might be that next week's podcast is the birthday edition, and we can have a whole other reminiscence intro as a result of that.
Well, it fills time, doesn't it?
It does.
Anyway, the podcast was presented by Andy Malt and Chris Cook, who, despite me leaving him off the notes once again. And for more information on CMU, you can go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an unlimited production in association with 7 Digital.